This program is sponsored by Motorola Solutions. The following is a production of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library. Bringing citizens and citizen soldiers together through the exploration of military history, topics, and current affairs. This is Pritzker Military Presents.
Welcome to Pritzker Military Presents with General Norton and Susie Schwartz discussing the book Journey, Memoirs of an Air Force Chief of Staff. I'm your host, John Schwan, and this program is coming to you from the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. It is sponsored by Motorola Solutions. This program and hundreds more are available on demand at PritzkerMilitary.org. Almost 40 years ago, General Norton Schwartz, driven by his dysfunctional home life, applied to the Air Force Academy. The Air Force provided him with a new family and a sense of worth he had never earned from his own father. Schwartz's time in the Air Force yielded a remarkable career, taking him to Alaska, the Pentagon, Germany, and to Florida during Hurricane Opal. His career has also allowed him to work alongside Presidents Bush and Obama and Secretaries of Defense Leon Panetta and Ashton Carter. His hard work and dedication eventually led to his selection as the first non-fighter or bomber pilot to become U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff. Throughout his career, his wife, Susie Schwartz, traveled alongside him as support for the military families under his purview. In their book, Journey, Memoirs of an Air Force Chief of Staff, Norton and Susie chronicle the phenomenal story of the evolution of the U.S. Special Operations and the controversial new technologies that have allowed America to build new capabilities in remote aircraft and cyber warfare. It is also an insight into the impact on military families and weathering challenges as a family. General Norton Schwartz is a U.S. Air Force Academy graduate and holds a master's degree in business administration from Central Michigan University. A command pilot with more than 4,400 flying hours in a variety of aircraft, Schwartz participated as a crew member in the 1975 airlift evacuation of Saigon, and in 1991 served as Chief of Staff of the Joint Special Operations Task Force for Northern Iraq in Operation Desert Shield and Desert Storm. Prior to assuming his position as Chief, General Schwartz commanded his U.S. Transportation Command, where he was the single manager for global land and sea transportation for the Department of Defense. General Schwartz was sworn in on August 12, 2008 as the U.S. Air Force Chief of Staff and served until his retirement in 2012. In 2013, he joined Business Executives for National Security as President and CEO. Susie Schwartz is the Vice President for Military Spouse Programs for Victory Media, the publisher of Military Spouse Magazine. She has long been a champion for military spouses and families working to support them in achieving their goals. A graduate of the University of Arkansas, she began her professional career as a special education teacher. While at Scott Air Force Base, she worked with the Fisher House Foundation to establish a comfort home for the VA hospital in St. Louis, and more recently was instrumental in the establishment of another Fisher House facility at Dover Air Force Base in Delaware. She has served as an Air Force Aid Society board member, performed key roles on the Air Force Charity Ball Committee. She also actively participated in the White House Joining Forces Initiative with a purpose to mobilize all sectors of American society to support the military community. Please join me in welcoming to the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, General Norton Schwartz and Susie Schwartz. The book, Journey of an Air Force Chief of Staff. Susie, I'd like to start with you. Mm-hmm. Why did you write the book? And what did you hope to achieve by telling the story?
Sure. That's a great question because I'm the one person that didn't want to write the book. So everyone thinks it was my idea, and it absolutely was not. And I'm the outgoing one. I am the one, I'm the social butterfly of the two of us, trust me. But I was uncertain about that just because we were not normal Air Force, and I sort of didn't want to subject him to criticism. But once it got going, I was pretty much into it, and it was nice to have my perspective. And in fact, during the reception, somebody said that they'd never read a military memoir that actually included both of them in it. So I'm happy that I did, and I hope I show that we're not just standing behind them smiling, that we actually can make a difference.
I agree with that.
That's your support for it.
Well, you know, it's true that it took 4 years to put this together. It was not a light lift, frankly. But it actually, I think, turned out to be something that we were proud of. It had two major purposes, I think, fundamentally. One was that we thought there might be a message and perhaps a model for future military couples. Susie was a professional in the hotel business for many years, and of course then devoted herself to Air Force families. So this is not atypical of modern military couples today. So the message for couples, and then there were some decisions that we took during my tenure that some didn't turn out that well, frankly, but we thought it would be important to share the thought process that we use for making those choices in a professional context, and that perhaps successors might find those insights useful. So those were the two motivations, one, the couple side of things, and the other, how did we go about making choices and decisions for our Air Force?
Since you brought it up, let's talk about the love story aspect of this. How did you meet, Susie?
We both went out on blind dates and on New Year's Eve, and I was home before midnight, which is a sign that mine did not go well. And so my friend had met Nort at this same event, a good girlfriend, and then she went out with him months later, but then she called me the night of that she got home from the date and said, I've met the man for you. So I guess that's a good friend, or Nort was a reject, you know, I don't know which.
Probably both.
So she finagled ways that I could meet Nort, and it comes to find out that we lived in the same apartment complex in North Little Rock, Arkansas. And we found that out by searching at night with our flashlights. I don't know if anybody else did that in college, but that's how we found where people lived in college, was driving around and going up to mailboxes and looking, and I don't know why we did that anyway, but we did. And she invited him to a wedding where I was the maid of honor, so he could see me dressed up, and he came, which I think is probably the most unbelievable thing of that whole story. This is a Southern wedding. There's not a big party afterwards. There's cake and punch underneath the church. And he didn't know the bride or the groom or anybody, but he came. And we started dating and continued to date after that. So yep. That's how we met.
So Angie was, Angie was the gal that Susie's friend that I dated, and we're grateful to her.
Are you still friends with her?
Yes.
Yep.
You never know how these
that's
things.
Right.
We can't do the ending this
that's
quick,
right, that's
quick
right.
Norty. Yeah. We really can't.
Yeah.
Norty, why did you decide to join the military?
I always had a inclination toward public service, I think. And of course, this is in the late 60s. And the reality was that my dad sold typewriters for a living, the old Olivetti's, the Royals, the Underwoods, the manuals. Folks,
I'm not sure anybody knows what those are.
That's right, but those were typewriters. And my older brother was in school in New York, and we weren't all that well-to-do. And so the deal was Dad couldn't quite swing having both of us in school at the same time. So either I got a ride or I waited out 2 years, which was the plan, frankly. But one of the counselors at school knew that I had an interest in aviation and suggested that I apply to Annapolis. By the way, I grew up in a small town in South Jersey, so we knew of Annapolis, and we did that. And then late in the game, someone else suggested applying to the Air Force Academy. The interesting thing is that at the time, I didn't know where Colorado was, much less Colorado Springs. But it turned out that I didn't get into Annapolis, which has been the source of some jest between me and my Navy counterparts over the years. But I was a first alternate to the Air Force Academy. And the young fellow that was the primary choice of Congressman Cahill at the time, then governor of New Jersey, his name was Steve Manning, and he was the quarterback of the high school football team in the town adjacent to ours, Brick Township, which, for those of you from the Jersey area, you know that Brick Township was the football powerhouse in South Jersey in those days. And the problem was that Steve had a bad knee, and he couldn't pass the entrance physical. So I got in because of his misfortune. And then, interestingly, Manning went on to be a Division II All-American anyway. So the question really is, did the Air Force get the best deal on this? We're not quite sure.
Not sure.
But the bottom line is, I was the first alternate, and because of his misfortune, I got in.
I would say the Air Force got the best of the deal. I take it you couldn't get in the infantry.
I actually...
There's a booing out there.
Yeah,
so
that's
you,
right.
So you
there's at least one person in the audience that knows a little bit about my background with special tactics. So it's, we appreciate, the folks that can that are the warriors on the ground.
A question I have to ask. You were involved in the evacuation in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Where did you take them out of?
The first mission, we went into Tansanut, and that was, actually fairly uneventful. The second mission, we went into Benoit, and that was not so uneventful. The base was under attack at the time, and it was crazy on the ground. And I was in the right seat. The left seat pilot was a captain by the name of Dave Antoon, who was probably the most experienced instructor in the squadron, and therefore had to put up with me in the right seat. But it was one of those seminal experiences where we got to understand what airlift, tactical airlift in particular, really does. We took 300 people. On pallets out of Vietnam that day, and the C-130 is not that big an airplane. 300 people in the back is sardine can kind of loading.
I can't even imagine.
300 people. We took the airplane to Guam, so it's a 5-hour trip from Benoit or so to Guam, and we're coming into Guam, and we're cleared to land, and there's an airplane on the runway, C-141, as a matter of fact, and so this wasn't going to work, and so we had to take it around, and as soon as the power came in to take the airplane back around for landing, everyone in the back, what we used to call, blew their cookies. It was inevitable, it was predictable, but it was not a pleasant place in the back of the airplane with 300 people not feeling well. And I'll never forget, we had to wash out the inside of the airplane that night. But the key point of that story really was to see how grateful they were nonetheless, escaping, I think, what they believed was a very uncertain future.
Did you go back again?
No.
A few more lifts, that was there.
There were two missions that we flew, one to Tansanut and one to Benoit.
Were you involved in selecting who got on?
No. This was done by the ground party, and it wasn't a pretty thing on the second one. The first, Tansanut was pretty well organized, Benoit was not. And so, you know, our loadmasters had basically, when we were more than we could handle, had to say no more. And you know, that was an emotional experience, to be sure.
And obviously impacted you.
Yep.
But by the same token, I happen to, as a minor aside, the current general in charge of the first CAV was a Vietnamese who was on that airstrip.
Ah. Wow.
Yeah, and I, at the reunion, I couldn't believe it.
We know one of the chairman's former special assistants, who's now retired, was also a Vietnam escapee. So I think there's a message in that we're better for those escapees, actually.
The mission had value.
Right.
No question.
You bet.
What was it like to be the wife of a young Air Force officer?
Oh.
And a pilot.
Sure. It was not what I thought it was going to be like. How about that? I was a brat, so I thought I knew. So I was stupid. So we moved to Fort Walton Beach, 1981. First time we had a fight, I got mad, and I got in my car, and I drove to the mall. And the mall was about 10 stores, so I was home like in half an hour. And that defeated my purpose somehow. That wasn't right, and there wasn't anything to buy in that mall either. So yeah. That was not a good thing. I wasn't prepared to be the spouse, how about that? I really was not. Just a small story. We got married on a Saturday night in Little Rock. We had our reception. The cruises in those days left on Saturday nights. Now they're smarter and they leave on Sunday after, so you can get to them. So we had a week in between. So on Sunday, we drove 11 hours to Fort Walton Beach, Florida. And Monday morning at 6 a.m., he's at work. And I don't know where. I don't have a phone number. I would never call him if I knew the number anyway, because that was very bad. And so there I am in this house that he bought, and I left my car, my job, my apartment, and whoa. So I cried every day, and then figured it out, and it didn't take me long, and I figured out, I finally made some friends. But I had to go to the Wives Club, which I didn't want to go to. That was what my mother did, and I didn't want to go. And the first one I went to, I met my friend, Honey Jennings.
Forever.
Who is my friend today. And I'm so glad that I did. And I see her every time that we're in Fort Walton. She still lives in the same house. I don't know how that's possible, but she does. And so I slowly figured it out. But it wasn't the life I thought it was going to be. And then I wanted him to get out. So I used to cut out ads from the back of, I think, the Air Force magazine, maybe? They were United or...
No, it actually was Braniff and Eastern.
Braniff and Eastern. Yeah, too. He always reminds me that it was two airlines that didn't last very long. That imagine what would have happened had he left. But I used to cut out the physical little ad and literally place it in his seat of his car so that maybe he'd see it in the morning. But it didn't work. It didn't work.
I saw them.
He never said and he never said a peep. He just tossed them aside. He never said one word.
Did they have any support group at Fort Walton Beach for the wives?
You know, yes. They had the spouse club. And people think it, people make fun of them and make think that they were old school. And they were not, because they were what we needed at the time.
Yeah.
You didn't Skype. You didn't do any of that. They didn't tell you where they were going. And they most certainly didn't tell you how to get a hold of them. And they really didn't tell you when they were coming home either. So they did have that. They didn't have outside things. There weren't community groups that were all supportive like there are today.
Yeah.
But we had each other through the spouse club.
And I would just add that I was gone for 9 of the first 15 months that we were married. It was, you might recall that there, after the first Desert One mission, there was an effort, a preparation for a second attempt. And I had some association with that. And so we were out of town for, a good deal of time. And so, Sue sort of had the situation she described, but it was, in those days, as Susie suggested, you'd never called a squadron, you never called your spouse, it was different than it is today. And I might just emphasize that that's one of the reasons why maybe our book can connect with today's families, that, it didn't start perfectly for us, I think it's fair to say. And I'm lucky that Susie didn't kick me to the curb, because she had many opportunities. But the bottom line is, military families are unique. They have many challenges. We had a few, and maybe there's a story here for them.
How often did you move?
We moved every 2 years and then some. So 2 years was the longest we lived anywhere until the very, very end.
Right.
And so I never even had those 3 years. Some people had those 3-year assignments early, but we didn't get those. I don't know who got those, but it wasn't us. So I was not totally prepared for that. And then I thought I was going to be a school teacher. I thought that would be easily transferable, and it most assuredly was not.
How did they? Go ahead. You wanted to say something.
No, I was just going to say, back in the day, credentials in professions like teaching or others, didn't transfer from state to state. That's something that we have worked hard to fix with the current generation. But that was an obstacle to employment for spouses in those days.
Right. So I went, this is a seminal moment in my life, I think, whatever. I went from them going out to your car, seeing if you had a sticker on your car, from them just rejecting your resume because they could see that you were moving all the time. So that was the beginning of my journey, married to my husband. And then at the end, I sat in the U.S. Chamber of Commerce building where Mrs. Obama and Mrs. Biden rolled out their part of joining forces, and it was the Military Spouse Employment Partnership, right, which is still alive today. And I sat on the front row with Nort and bawled my eyes out. And he's like, "What in the world is wrong with you? This is not like a Wounded Warrior event or anything. This is a happy event." But I sat there and I was crying tears of joy to right. think that in my lifetime I would see businesses, organizations say that they will actively pursue the employment, not just of veterans, but of military spouses as well. And that was a happy, happy moment for me.
How?
Thank you.
How often were you deployed overseas in your?
A dozen times, probably. The one that was the most challenging, I think, was Susie worked for Hyatt for many years, and there was at a point in time when I was going to go to European Command in Stuttgart, And this was a seminal moment in her career path. And so Susie stayed in Washington to pursue that opportunity, and I went Class B to Stuttgart. Of course, Desert Shield, Desert Storms occurred during that period, and so, you know, it was one of those things where I probably would have been, you know, not home in any case. But the bottom line is, I'll never forget one funny thing happened. On the very first night that I was in Stuttgart, I get a call from Susie, and you know, it was like 6 hours difference, so it's like 2 a.m. And Susie says, you know, that we had a diesel in those days, okay? I never had one since. But she calls and says that the diesel's not running. Remember?
Oh, yeah.
And
I remember.
And it turned out that we got a mix-up on the fuel for the diesel. And I thought to myself in Stuttgart, now how am I going to help Susie from here? Remember that?
Oh, yeah.
So that was the first night of our voluntary separation. Right. I'll never
forget
it.
And I take it you were no help.
No, he was no help, yeah.
You know, okay.
No, he was no help.
Susie, I could see you wanted to say that.
Yeah, he was no help at all, no.
You figured it out yourself.
Susie took care of it as she did with so many things.
Right, right.
Norty, how many different aircraft did you fly?
Well, I was very fortunate in that I was a C-130 transport guy in the beginning, but I migrated to special operations in 1980 and spent 25 years in that business, more or less. And so I got to fly every version of the Herc, the Hercules, in the special ops business, from the gunship to the Talon to the King, the tanker, and so on and so forth. And then later in life, I also, not very good at it, but got to fly the special ops helicopters as well. And for us, it was the MH-53 and the MH-60 versions of the Black Hawk.
Did you fly them on missions for special ops?
Yes, the short answer is, particularly as a younger fella, when I was flying the fixed-wing platforms, you know, we had a number of things to do, as some of the people here in the audience know. And I guess I would just mention that the fortune that I had was that, you know, I was part of the post-Desert One generation. Several of my colleagues, my counterparts, my contemporaries were Desert One veterans. Pete Schoomaker, a case in point, Doug Brown, others. On the Navy side, Eric Olson was a member of that generation. And what happened was that this group of captains in those days, you know, basically decided that what happened at Desert One would never happen again. And it took 30 years to achieve redemption. But in May 2011, I remember Susie and I were upstairs in the bedroom in Air House as the chief at the time, and, you know, listened to the president indicate that a mission had gone into Abbottabad to take down bin Laden, had been successful, and that it didn't go as planned. But what happened was that in the intervening 30 years, we built resilience and the ability to improvise and the ability to pursue the mission despite disruptions and you know, the absence of perfect planning. And so, the bin Laden mission for my generation was redemption.
Did they upgrade the aircraft by that time?
Oh, sure.
In terms of, so what you were flying, so
oh, my.
Why don't you put us in...
In fact, before you finish telling, the email that he got that night said...
Yes.
They let the Cadillac out of the garage. And that kind of said it all.
That said it all. And it was, you know, it was a great moment. And I think, you know, it's one of those things, again, that Susie grew up in that business as well, early reluctantly, but later devoted like all were. And it's a wonderful thing that, you know, this country still has and will always have, in my view, the premier special operations capability on the planet. And the lesson that we took away from that searing experience on the 25th of April, 1980, in the desert southwest of Tehran, was that if we do not perform, even presidencies can fail. That's the gravity of the work that the people in this community perform. And so it was my privilege, and I think Susie would agree with that, for us to serve in that community for so many years.
And you were part of the whole planning process also?
It's interesting. The short answer is no. The chiefs were not open to this mission. Okay, the Joint Chiefs were not open to the Bin Laden mission. However, I was in my office one day and I got a call on our secure line from the vice chairman. And the vice chairman said, "I can't tell you why, but I assure you this is real, it's legit. I need you to prepare a certain number of the weapons that we had in Ogden Air Force Base in Utah that were non-attributable. In other words, they didn't have U.S. markings and so on and so forth." So I said, okay, and so I called out to the two-star that runs the Ogden Air Logistics Area, and I said, "I can't tell you why, but this is your chief calling, and it's legitimate. I need you to prepare X number of weapons," which we did. And so I had an intuition that something was percolating, but clearly, the decision was that the chiefs were not going to be part of the decision process. I think that was probably a mistake, but it's clearly the call of the leadership of the department, including the chairman. And so it turned out, of course, the decision was not to obliterate the Abbottabad compound, but rather to do a capture-kill mission, which we all know about very well. So that's the background on the Bin Laden mission. And it's an interesting evolution that the chiefs were not privy.
Would you say that we were much better prepared and are now to perform those missions?
Infinitely better. And the evidence is what the guys did when the helicopter went down. You know, there's this classic picture of the Situation Room with Brad Webb, you may recall, who was then a one-star, was a deputy at the Joint Special Operations Command, sitting there looking at his computer when all the other leadership of America was sitting around the table. And Brad Webb now is a three-star. Brad Webb was a captain, helo, Pavlo pilot, MH-53 pilot, when we were still at Hurlburt back in the day. And, you know, again, there's an example of what happened, which was we grew generations of leadership who understood the gravity of the mission, who understood how to address diversity, and lead, not turn around en route on a mission of national importance. And they didn't, and they did what they were tasked to do. And so, you know, Brad Webb is now the commander of the Air Force Special Operations Command. It makes us just a little bit proud. And, you know, the babies grow up, right, Sue?
Babies grow up, yeah.
Yeah.
Is the training better now than
profoundly?
When you...
Oh, absolutely. And this is what happened over that 30-year period. You know, we practiced, we did the what-ifs, we perfected the planning. Importantly, we brought in the support side of special operations. It, you know, it's not just the shooters. The support side of the business makes it happen. And that was one of the, you know, the great achievements, I think, of our generation, Pete Schoomaker foremost among them, that decided that it was the maintainers, it was the medics, it was the communicators and the intelligence personnel. They all had to feel that they were profoundly important to the outcome, and that's what happened.
And can I say too that we are truly a joint force? Yeah. And so in the very beginning, it was joint ad hoc,
right.
And today it is joint. I still have an opportunity to mentor spouses as they attend Capstone, which is a course at National Defense University. And I look at them and they are positive, they are wonderful, but they are joint. They only know joint. They don't know anything else.
Yep, and joint means all services.
And
Capstone is the new Brigadier General or Rear Admiral course that Susie mentors.
Now, your part.
Yes.
Which has been throughout all of this.
Right.
How much better have you gotten in terms of mentoring what was once your peers and preparing them for the military life that you had to live?
Let me start with one story, if I may.
Okay, and then, go ahead.
And then you can talk about the contemporary.
Sure.
We had a squadron at McCord Air Force Base in the Seattle area in Washington State. And Susie was working at the time. That's a story all by itself. But the bottom line was that there was a group of young spouses in that squadron that Susie inspired back then. And the wonderful thing is they are still close to us almost 35 years later.
Yes.
That gives you a sense of how profound Susie's impact was on youngsters at the time. Now, the question is...
So fast forward, I got an email about 6 months ago, and the title on the email said, C-130 Baby. And she said, you met me 30 years ago when I was born while Nort was a squadron commander. And she is now married to an Army Ranger down in Florida. And she happens to be the Eglin Air Force Base Spouse of the Year as an Army spouse. That means that we're joint. And so she wanted to reach out to me to say that she'd heard about me through those all these years from her mother and father. And so we've had conversations, and I'm mentoring her as we speak. So, yes, nobody mentored me. It was you learn by watching when I was younger, and I always followed people that weren't very involved. So, kind of whatever I did was usually deemed as okay. I'm pretty outgoing. I'm brutally honest, to a fault honest, I have had some good mentors, though, later on. They came later.
Yeah.
I had Mary Jo Myers, whose husband was the chairman. I always wanted to be her. I am not her. I got an email from her today, as a matter of fact. But she is much gracious. I don't know the word. She's a little more calm than I am, and better at names than I am by far. Lynn Pace was a wonderful entertainer, and her husband was the Marine, also the chairman. And those were wonderful mentors to me.
So your contributions, both of your contributions, but I'm addressing you, if I may, your contributions to the military and to the service of our country have never stopped.
No, they continue. In fact, people ask me, when are you going to stop? When are you going to slow down? Sometime, but not quite yet. I feel like you have a window. So this is where it comes from, really. I resisted being involved. Honest to goodness, I resisted it like you cannot believe. And probably until he was about a one star, and then I gave in a little bit. And then at the three star level, I kind of jumped in with both feet and said, I'm in. But you have a window where, as a four star spouse, you can affect change if you choose to. You don't have to, but you can make an impact if you choose to.
So why not?
Yeah. And then after you retire, you have another small window where you can affect change. So why not? And that's what I choose to do.
Tell the story about Dover.
Dover. Okay, so they mentioned Dover at the Fisher House. So this is Dover. We go to Dover in the beginning of...
This is April of 2009.
Yeah, so right after 9/11, when remains would be returned home, the administration chose not to have families go to Dover. They wanted, and it wasn't a bad decision, it was, they wanted the families to stay home and be there to welcome the remains at home, surrounded by their family. That was the thinking, don't ask me, but anyway. So they changed the policy, and they had 6 months to come up with a plan. So the Air Force, and it's a joint command actually at Dover, the mortuary is.
Dover is at Dover Air Force Base on the East Coast in Delaware.
And the military mortuary is there.
Is there.
So they had 6 months to come up with this plan. And they did it quite well as far as the military was concerned. So I flew up there, and there were three families returning home and having a loved one return that evening. And they sat in a space not as big as this stage, which was an annex to an old chapel, on blue folding chairs with fluorescent lights on their head, and all these dignified transfers always seem to happen at 2 a.m., 4 a.m., I don't know. And so I had time to observe these families, and I was watching them, and there was happy, sad, happy family, not happy, but stoic family, crying, crazy family, and very religious family, as they have every right to react to that situation in any way they choose. But I was afraid in that small confine that they were going to attack each other. I swear to you, I really was. Yes. And I just thought, we can do better. So I got on the plane, and you sit across from each other on the plane. It's a short 40 minutes from Dover to Andrews Air Force Base. And I was like in his face, poking him. And I said, you can do better. America can do better.
Here's the thing. I had to sort of, I got to get up for these things. So I wanted to try to comfort the families. So I'm trying to do that well. I didn't observe any of the surroundings. You know, Susie says, did you see? I said, see what? She said, did you see the chairs? They were sitting on metal chairs. I said, I didn't see the chairs. You know, and as she suggested, she said that, you know, we must do better than this. And so...
As a spouse, you could be a little more free. And so I contacted the USO and said, what are you guys doing? They were building a USO center there. And I said, help us. And I want to make a place for the families to wait. And within 6 months, we found a... former Class 6 store, which is a liquor
package
store. Within 6 months, we opened up this Center for the Families of the Fallen, and it's still open today. And I will—I have to tell you that Broyhill stopped the furniture line so they could finish the furniture for this facility so it could be done by Christmas. Artisans from across the country drove to Dover and volunteered, gave their artwork. Almost every garden club in America donated something. My mother called me very proud that her garden club was donating to this facility at Dover, and she thought she was telling me something I didn't know. And I spoiled it for her and said, yes, I know. So that center is still there. It's run by volunteers. We now then have a Fisher House there. We have a meditation garden, and it is still up and running. And I will tell you in public that I have gotten the Fisher House to be committed to help me when the center needs some renovation. I don't want it to let it fall. Yeah. And if I need to, we're going to dive in and help it because I want it to be nice.
And this is all about providing a place where the families have a degree of privacy, where they can deal with the grief. And then, and be done in a way that, again,
they can be in private rooms. They can be together. There's a library. There's a kids' room. There's makeup for them if the spouses feel they need to. There's cookies and there's a kitchen. Everything is in there because they sometimes wait there for several hours. Yes. It's not just they come and then go out to the flight line.
That's one of Susie's legacies is. The Center for the Families of the Fallen.
Now, as you've...
Thank you.
you both, and I mean both, have lived a life of public service. And obviously a life that's dedicated to our country. My question is, what can we do as citizens to serve the service members better?
Susie will have her own answer, but let me give a shout out to Jennifer Pritzker. I mean, this institution is an example of a way to connect with a broader American audience on the value of service and you know, the stories that are associated with that service. So, I mean, let's not forget where we're sitting, to be sure. But I think, for me, you know, we have a volunteer armed forces. That is the right thing, given the complexity of the work that the armed forces are required to do today. However, there's a downside to a professional force in that we're not connected to the broader American population as well as we should be. And as a result, you know, there are families out there that and there are opinion leaders that should, I think, tell the story of public service. There is nobility in public service, whether it's in the military or in some other civilian pursuit. But the America needs good people to do this stuff. And so my appeal would be to people here in the audience and more broadly that opinion leaders need to tell the story of why the country needs quality people doing the kinds of work that you refer to, and to encourage kids to do it, even though there is risk. Of course there's risk, but that's part of what makes this noble.
Susie?
Sure. A little bit the same as him, connect with your community. There are military people in your community. There's recruiting stations right here in Chicago, and I bet nobody ever stops in there to say hello to those men and women. And those are hard assignments.
Yes.
They're really tough. So to continue connecting, I see less and less of people thanking people in the airports anymore. That kind of thing makes me a little bit sad. But I would say really work hard to connect to people. If you have an event, don't just buy a table and let them sit. Invite two people and have them sit with you. That's the key. I say that all the time. It's really nice that you invite them to these big things and they honor, you know, at the Nats game, and I'm sure at the Cubs or whichever team you choose cheer for here, that they honor the military there. But it is more about trying to connect on that personal level. I think that's really the key.
That's one of the goals at the Pritzker,
of course,
Library and of Jennifer. We bring the military here along with the civilians, mm-hmm. so we can show them we appreciate it.
All right.
And we appreciate you too.
Thank you.
And now, what books would you recommend us?
There are three books that were sort of key at different points in my career. Desert One was the seminal experience for me for my entire career. And there's a book by the name of All Fall Down by Gary Sick, a professor from Columbia, which talks about how that whole situation evolved. And it was an important book in the early days. Another one that I think is excellent. It's called Circle in the Sand by Christian Alfonsi. Given that I was the J3 at the time, as we were preparing for and then executing Iraqi freedom, as well as the mission in Afghanistan, Circle in the Sand is a really interesting study of why that all occurred. Some people won't agree with it, but it's a worthy read. And then the last one that I would mention is by Steve Call, and it's called Ghosts. Oh gosh, I'm drawing a blank. But it's about Afghanistan, and it's about the challenges that we faced and continue to face. Ghost Wars, that's what it's called. The title is Ghost Wars. Steve Call does a great job in explaining the dilemmas in Afghanistan. Those are three that were important to me.
You got one?
I have one.
Okay.
Okay. Well, I have two, I think, and I don't even, I'm not very good at remembering names of books, but I think
five.
It was Love Letters. Do you remember the Stockdale book? That was a searing memory in my brain. I'm not sure why it was so much, but it really was. I think Vietnam was searing only because I was a kid during Vietnam, and I lived on Clark Air Base, and for 2 years I watched the B-52s land over my school bus, and I wanted to volunteer in the hospital, and that was a no. They're not going to let you do that. That was one. And then also Vietnam, I guess, is it The Eye of the Cat? I think it's a Lance P. Sijin, who is a Medal of Honor recipient from the Air Force Academy. I'm not sure that's the exact name of it, but I was just at the Academy 2 weeks ago, and it really made me think of that book again. And that book made me realize, truly appreciate dedication of the people in our military.
Yeah. Now it's open for questions.
General, could you comment on the Space Corps?
Sure.
I figured not to touch that, so you know.
No,
Norty.
I'll tell you what. I think at the moment it's a distraction. There are those who believe that, and I'm being a little pejorative here, but I'm going to put this in stark terms. There are those who believe that air breathers will never understand space, that air breathers will always pursue those aspects of combat capability with which they grew up, with which they're familiar, and so on. I dismiss that notion. I know it's not true. And so the bottom line is that there may well be a time when a separate service makes sense, but it's not yet. That my view is that yes, we need to prepare for war fighting in space, but primarily space still supports war fighting on Earth. And so it's important that that capability be integrated with all the other aspects of air, land, surface, maritime, subsurface to make the best use of all of our armed forces. So the short, long answer to your short question is I think this is, you know, something that's a distraction from more pressing concerns at the moment.
What do you think of compulsory national service for all our youth?
The question was, you know, what do I think of compulsory national service? I think we should absolutely do that. It doesn't suggest that everybody needs to serve in the armed forces, but there are a multitude of civilian pursuits that again need good people to serve, and it may not be for 40 years. It may not be what works, but the bottom line is I think all of our youngsters, all of us, should feel some obligation to country, and to pay back a bit. And some might do that early, some might do it later, but compulsory service in some form at some point is, I think, essential to Americana going forward.
My question's in regard to drone technology. We've seen it rapidly escalate. Near term, how do you see it coexisting with manned flights? And ultimately, do you see it replacing manned aircraft?
Let me ask you a question. And then I'll answer your question. Would you put your grandchildren on a remotely piloted passenger carrying aircraft?
Absolutely.
Okay, I wouldn't yet. Maybe in 30 years, 20 years. But I think that the bottom line is that remote operations are excellent at a number of things. But for example, another question, would you put a nuclear weapon on a remotely piloted aircraft?
Yes.
Okay, I wouldn't.
I wouldn't.
Okay. So the bottom line is, I think that this is an area that will mature. Fred Smith from FedEx is working diligently on remotely piloted cargo carrying aircraft. That works for me. Lots of reasons to do that, both economic and otherwise. But the bottom line is, I think that we are just in the beginning of this process, and it's probably another 20 or 30 years before we fully appreciate and have confidence in what artificial intelligence and so on can bring to the table. But I would emphasize, sir, that I don't think we will ever take the person out of the loop, particularly on those things that involve the application of lethal force. Lethal force should not be done by robots or autonomous systems. That's something that humans should always make the final call.
Thank you, General. In your time with Special Operations, did you guys gain any insights from some of our allies, the Brits, the Canadians, the Israelis, that helped you and helped our forces?
No question. There was a time when GSG-9 was the best around. Not so much anymore, unfortunately. The Israelis clearly are very good. The SAS has always... Much of our culture is a result of SAS culture. In fact, one of our mentors, Dick Potter, an Army brigadier that General Sullivan knows well, did an exchange tour with the SAS back in the day. And of course, he was a deputy for Beckwith and Delta, and then, there's a lot of history there. But the bottom line is that absolutely, there are people that are very good at this sort of thing. They don't have the scale we have, and they typically don't have the resources at their disposal. But you can learn a lot from folks that do a lot with a little. Okay.
One question upstairs.
General McMaster's book, Dereliction of Duty, what impact might it have in your career, and what is the likelihood we'll see something like that come in the future, given the past several years?
When I learned that I was going to be assigned as the J3, the operations officer for the armed forces, essentially, I read McMaster's book again. That always stayed in the back of my mind about whether the chiefs or the people that support the chiefs gave the best possible military advice to the civilian leadership. And I must tell you that a personal view about Iraqi freedom. Many of us were taken with the mythology of liberation. The notion that Iraq was the cradle of civilization, that Iraq was the most educated population in the Middle East. It was Mesopotamia. And so the mythology of liberation had a great appeal. It certainly persuaded me. However, as we all know looking back now, but in many ways, I feel that our generation of leadership didn't serve the country as well as we might have, in the same way that, you know, McMaster talked about people consciously deciding not to challenge the conventional wisdom. What happened with Iraqi freedom was that I think the mythology took over good analysis in many ways. It did with me, and I feel responsible for not having been more critical, more questioning of the underlying assumptions that you know the Iraqis would celebrate their freedom. So, long answer to your question is, yes, McMaster's book remains relevant. It should be read by anyone that serves in a joint billet, but particularly in Washington. And I must say that in my own view, I didn't live up to his expectations.
I'd like to thank you for your service, both of you.
Thank you.
Appreciate it. Thank you to General Norton Schwartz and Susie Schwartz for an outstanding discussion, and to Motorola Solutions for sponsoring this program. The book is Journey, Memoirs of an Air Force Chief of Staff. To learn more about the Pritzker Military Museum and Library, visit in person or online at PritzkerMilitary.org. Thank you, and please join us next time for Pritzker Military Presents.
Visit the Pritzker Military Museum and Library in downtown Chicago. Explore original exhibits on military history or be a part of a live studio audience. Watch other episodes of Pritzker Military Presents. Find out what's on at PritzkerMilitary.org. Pritzker Military Presents is made possible by members of the Pritzker Military Museum and Library and its sponsors. The views and opinions expressed in this program are not necessarily those of the museum and library. The preceding program was produced by the Pritzker Military Museum and Library.